As the dust settled across the world in the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars, attention was turning, as it had done many times over the centuries after a major European-centred dust-up, to dealing with the Barbary Corsairs. This series of small kingdoms that had spun out of Ottoman and general Islamic expansion attempts along the North African coast had survived hundreds of years predating on the coastline of Europe by a combination of factors. Mostly, though, it was thanks to the labyrinthine nature of European power politics. The Corsairs were just powerful enough to merit a considerable force to deal with, and a navy that dispatched such a force would thus weaken itself enough at home to be at risk from other navies attacking it. On top of that, since the Corsairs were also quite open to selling their services to the highest bidder, they were usually at least ignored, or in some cases protected directly or indirectly, by a variety of European powers who found them quite useful to point at their enemies. Cap this off with the ability to, if things got really bad, simply retreat inland and then come back and rebuild once the attacker was gone, since the various expeditions didn't tend to bring armies as well as navies, and even when they did, the Corsairs tended to play the long game. And their combination of piracy and slaving, although it waxed and waned in intensity, was still going fairly strong in the early 19th century. There was also the fact that the Corsairs were composed of several independent states, so going after one of them didn't necessarily do anything to deter the others. If anything, it opened up new markets for them, especially given that each state tended to have its own system of alliances and tributes. In more recent times, in the run-up to and during the Napoleonic Wars, the Corsairs had preyed quite extensively on the new American merchant fleet, which they found, to their delight, lacked the protection of any serious navy, or the protection of any allies with a serious navy of their own. This, in turn, had led to the US Congress rather quickly reversing course on the whole "we don't need a navy" position, and then to the First and Second Barbary Wars. The former had been a much more drawn-out affair that had eventually led to promises of safe passage for American shipping without the need to pay tribute. However, during the War of 1812, with the US Navy otherwise occupied, the Corsairs had resumed targeting American ships. The Second Barbary War had been much shorter, and it essentially just been a case of threatening and shooting at them enough to reset terms back to how things had been at the end of the First Barbary War. However, while weakened, the Barbary states were not out of action entirely, and indeed they immediately started looking to recoup any losses suffered to the Americans by increasing their attacks on other shipping. Over the course of the recent European wars, the Corsair states had seized a great deal of wealth and slaves from various European ships and towns. While some had been freed at various points as part of deals or ransoms involving the transfer of large sums of money, or when alliances shifted, there were still thousands of slaves held in the various Corsair cities. Some had been there for decades. During most of the Napoleonic Wars, the British had seen a certain advantage in leaving the Corsairs alone, partly due to the fact the Royal Navy was at one point, admittedly, fighting most of the combined navies of Europe at the same time and thus had slightly bigger fish to fry, and in part because, well, the nearest targets for the Corsairs tended to be the ships of continental Europe, which, as we just said, the Royal Navy was fighting anyway, so an additional force that they didn't have to pay, raiding and taking French, Spanish, and other merchant ships, was advantageous. Indeed, the British government had even sold the captured Spanish frigate El Gamo to the Algerian Corsairs rather than give it to the captain who actually captured her, Cochrane, in the middle of said conflict. Thanks to the Corsairs' willingness to do almost anything if you pay them the right amount of money, they'd also proved to be rather handy contractors when it came to keeping Gibraltar supplied while Spain was hostile to Britain, as their fast ships and experienced sailors proved rather adept at slipping past patrolling Spanish warships. Now, that isn't to say opinion on the Corsairs was a monolith of positivity in Britain. Most of these considerations were political, only a few were tactical or strategic. The Royal Navy and its men generally held the Corsairs in considerably lower regard than those back home, and they saw the lack of action against them as, at best, a byproduct of having bigger foes to fight. The rising general anti-slavery sentiment in both British society as a whole and legislatively in particular also had strong advocates in the Royal Navy. And while the West Africa Squadron was an effort that attracted much approval, the racial and religious politics of the time meant that many began to ask, if such efforts were being undertaken to liberate non-Christian Africans from bondage, why was nothing being done about the white Christian slaves being held by the corsairs, which included British citizens? For this purpose, the government was persuaded to send a small formation of Royal Navy ships under the command of Admiral Edward Pellew, who'd recently been made Lord Exmouth. And yes, that's that Pellew, the one who'd spent quite a bit of the previous conflict terrorising the King's enemies aboard the Razé frigate HMS Indefatigable. Now aboard the ship of the line HMS Boyne, he understandably wanted to go in, free all the slaves, compel the corsairs to end slaving and piracy, and back it all up with a threat of extreme violence. However, certain political elements at the time, the same ones who were trying to hamstring the West Africa Squadron, along with a faction of politicians that wanted peace at all costs, since they'd just come out of a very expensive war, ordered him only to negotiate for the release of British captives and those who might fall under British sovereignty, and he was allowed to ask for the corsairs to abandon slavery, but he was told he couldn't demand it. Pellew was quite annoyed by this, but he wasn't entirely without recourse. He had a fearsome reputation, which would protect him to a degree from any political backlash, and since he was half a century before even the existence of the telegraph, once he was out at sea, he could, to a certain extent, do pretty much what he wanted. So once his force entered the Mediterranean, he began a series of preparations, only some of which the officials back in London were aware of, and many of which they would remain ignorant of until well after the fact. Firstly, he began a tour of the various European states who'd been victimised by the corsairs, mentioning, well, he was on his way to negotiate for the release of the British subjects held captive there, and if they wanted their own subjects released, well, he'd happily add those captives to the negotiations, as long as they authorised him to do so, and, if necessary, would pay the necessary ransoms. Quite a few rulers, especially of a number of Italian city-states who on their own stood very little chance of forcing the corsairs' hands, signed up pretty much immediately, although weirdly enough the Papal States said thanks but no thanks. He also knew that of the three main corsair states, Tripoli, Tunis and Algiers, the latter was by far the most powerful and defiant, so he initially resolved to approach the other two first, while dispatching HMS Banterra to Algiers. She wasn't on a diplomatic mission, but rather on a recon mission to observe exactly how well defended the place was and how those defences were laid out. His instructions to Captain Ward of the Banterra were read in part as follows. The object of your mission is to discover, with apparent indifference in the state of Algiers, as to its defences by both land and sea, and the number of real troops they can depend on. The sea defences are the first object. If you're allowed to enter, endeavour to pass along the outside of the mole and sound the offside of the brig, and so on until you anchor. Be precise in the distance of the mole head from the town, across the harbour, to ascertain if Boyne can place herself across the mouth of it. Observe if she can be flanked or raked from the walls, supposing her anchored with her head off to seaward and her stern to the city. Observe if any flanking batteries on either side can play upon her, particularly if the lighthouse battery can fire in that direction down the mole. Take notice if, from walls or houses, a ship so placed would be commanded by musketry. I believe the walls are high. Take minutes of the number of guns mounted on the sea face of the mole and lighthouse, and if of heavy calibre. Minute the sea batteries to the north of the city, and if approachable near, discover if the Dey is popular or not, and the character of his probable successor. Find out if there is any particular person likely to be bold enough to take a popular lead in the event of any public clamour. Discover where the Dey's palace is situated, and take leading marks to direct shells to it, or any magazines of powder, or where the market lays. Endeavour to discover how much powder and shot they may have, and of course you will minutely discover the floating force of all sorts, and how they are best got at, and if in any state of preparation. Observe if the ship laying along the face of the mole will be high enough to fire over it, if silenced, into the city, or if by placing one at a particular spot, the gate from the mole into the city may be battered down. Observe if a frigate or gunboats may not be placed to advantage to the northwest of the lighthouse, and minute if any batteries could annoy them there, or prevent the firing into the mole on that side. Observe if there is any boom which would prevent fireboats from attempting the frigates or floating ships. Observe the bottom, if good holding, and having satisfied yourself on these points, return and join me. Captain Ward outdid himself, returning with such a detailed map, with over 100 notations breaking down the defences and the layout of the city in minute detail, that Pellew would later write recommending that Ward be officially commended for his actions, but the existing plans of Algiers proved to be hopelessly inaccurate in both the layout and strength of the fortifications and the depth of various parts of the harbour. Pellew thus changed his mind, and instead he headed first for Algiers. Upon arrival, although his squadron wasn't especially large, the combination of Pellew's own reputation and that of the Royal Navy meant that the rulers of Algiers readily agreed to free all British subjects and to ransom all the slaves they had from Naples and Sardinia, who had signed on to Pellew's liberation efforts. Now, this wasn't entirely out of keeping with Corsair politics. Having been attacked by the US Navy the year before, the Algerian Corsairs decided on what they usually did when they were attacked quite severely, and that was releasing some of their slaves to hostile powers was a significantly smaller loss than enduring another attack, especially since Pellew's terms made it clear that the British government seemed rather unwilling to press the matter any further. With hundreds of freed slaves aboard his ships, Pellew then headed for Tunis and then for Tripoli. Perhaps somewhat smarting from having to pretend to be polite in Algiers, he met with the rulers of these other cities, and there was a really tragic translation error. Instead of expressing that the British government would be very agreeable if slavery was abolished, the interpreter somehow ended up conveying the message that the Prince Regent, later to be King George IV, had been determined to abolish it. Faced with an apparent veiled threat backed up by firepower, within a matter of hours in each location, both Tunis and Tripoli agreed to comply with this requirement. All told, Pellew freed 1,792 slaves. But then he received new orders from London. Word had reached London, since he'd sailed off, of the terms of the agreement between Algiers and the USA, which included things like the right to sell prizes in the port and to refit privateers there, and he was instructed to return to Algiers and seek the same terms for the British. He took the chance to make a similar end your slavery demand to the rulers of Algiers. There was less risk to the slaves now that the ones he was most concerned with had been freed, and of course he could package his demand upgrade from "it'd be nice if you stop slaving" to "you will stop slaving" in with all the other new orders he'd received and claim that, well, he'd been updated as to what the government wanted. However, Algiers resisted the demand. Pellew hinted he might use force if he was refused, and the Algerians didn't seem to think all that much about that threat. Pellew told them he would give them 2 hours to consider his terms. But on his way back to the dockyard to reboard his ship, he was surrounded by a magically appearing mob who discussed openly killing him, only to then be freed from the mob by a senior official, who then asked him for 2 days to debate his demands. Pellew, rather angered by the blatant attempt at intimidation, told him nope, the 2-hour deadline remained, and got on board his boat, ordering his squadron to make ready for action. However, the wind was against him, although it turned out this was probably for the best, as two other captains, including Captain Ward, had gone ashore elsewhere, completely unaware of the developing situation, and were duly captured by the mob. It took some effort to get them back, and they might well have been killed out of hand had the squadron been able to take up its firing positions and opened an attack while they were still in Algerian hands. In the end, since he actually technically wasn't authorised to shoot up the place, Pellew eventually accepted the return of the captains and a promise that the Dey of Algiers would send an ambassador to Britain to negotiate further on the possible reduction of, or abolition of, slavery in his city. Accepting that this was probably about as good as he was going to get in the circumstances, even though he didn't trust the Dey of Algiers further than he could throw him, Pellew took the squadron home, writing a letter back to his family that alludes to just how far past his actual orders he'd taken things. It reads in part, "It is with great delight I again bring myself nearer to you and the rest of my family, after a longer absence than I had any reason to expect when I left England, and which has at last ended without realising that for which it was said we were kept so long abroad after peace was signed. I had anxiously hoped I should have been directed to enforce the abandonment of their cruel system of retaining Christians who fall into their hands, in what they term war, in slavery. I hope I have made the path easy for the government, having obtained by my own exertions the relinquishment from two states, that is Tripoli and Tunis, and a promise to treat on that point from the most violent, Algiers, after discussions which did not promise sometimes amicable terminations. But I entreat you to observe the utmost silence on this point, as it may lead me into an awkward situation, for I have acted solely on my own responsibility and without orders, the causes and reasoning on which, upon general principles, may be defensible, but, as applying to our own country, may not be borne out, the old mercantile interest being against it." He was right to be secretive, for his forces were still on their way home, having barely entered the Channel, when an MP stood up in Parliament, based on documents which he'd managed to acquire up to that point, and denounced Pellew's actions, his motion of censure being stayed only when it was pointed out that, well, Pellew had yet to arrive, and thus not all documents and accounts of what had actually occurred were indeed available. Moreover, as other MPs realised what was happening, they actually rallied and instead praised Pellew, with the net result being that another motion was passed instead, this one expressing praise and thanks for Pellew's actions. But it did show just how divided Parliament was on the subject. In fact, in the time between that debate and Pellew's ships making it up the Channel and docking, further news was reached in Britain, which revealed the true nature of the Corsairs of Algiers. But even while they'd been promising to send an ambassador to Britain, they'd already been taking steps to replenish their slave stocks while Pellew was still in Algiers harbour. The exact details of the accounts vary on exactly what sequence of events took place, but it seems that they found an area where there was a large gathering of Italian fishermen who'd been celebrating Ascension Day Mass, and landed troops further up the coast, who then marched down and attacked the gathering of fishermen, killing some and driving the rest towards the sea, where it was reported that Algerian galleys flying British flags hove close to shore, causing the fishermen to row and swim to them in hopes of safety, only for about 350 or so of them to find themselves instead captives and replacement slaves, since of course the galleys were in fact Algerian corsairs. That these particular Italians were from one of the city-states under British protection made the whole thing even more of an outrage, and scarcely had Pellew landed at home than he found the entire conversation around Algiers in the political realm had been completely upended, and he found himself handed a literal blank cheque. His orders were to force Algiers into submission or exact vengeance on them, whichever he chose, pretty much immediately, and by any and all means necessary. Due to previous inaccurate information about the strength of Algiers prior to Banterer's reconnaissance, it had previously been thought that a fleet of 25 ships of the line, essentially a fleet that was almost the equal to that with which Nelson had fought Trafalgar, would be needed to force Algiers into submission in a direct assault. So you can imagine everyone's surprise when Pellew, instead of announcing that he was taking half the navy with him, announced he would only need 5 ships of the line and some other ancillary vessels, this of course based on his updated information about what Algiers was actually defended by. The next thing he had to deal with was a veritable flood of volunteers, for as news spread of both his voyage and the Algerian treachery, it seemed that half the active Royal Navy and a good chunk of those on half pay wanted to come along. Indeed, he could pretty much have had 25 ships of the line fully manned by his pick of officers and ready to sail in days if that was what he'd chosen to do. Faced with such an influx of able officers, well in excess of the carrying capacity of his planned fleet, Pellew was forced to turn over most of the appointments to the Admiralty for fear of personally offending too many of his own friends and family, including his brother, Israel Pellew, who'd been with the squadron on the earlier voyage, but ultimately wasn't selected to go out for this one. The fleet soon came together, formed from some of the newest and most lethal ships the Royal Navy had to offer. A good number of them were well under 10 years old. The flagship was the 104-gun first-rate Queen Charlotte, accompanied by four other ships of the line, the 98-gun second-rate Impregnable, and the 74-gun third-rates Albion, Minden, and Superb. Three new fourth-rate heavy frigates, designed and built mostly for the War of 1812, the Leander, Glasgow, and Severn, along with two regular fifth-rate frigates, the Granicus and Hebrus, and seven or eight brigs and brig sloops, formed the main contingent, along with four bomb vessels, Beelzebub, Fury, Infernal, and Hecla, which rounded out the ships involved. But there were a number of smaller vessels that would also turn up. Along for the ride was the four-gun HMS Express, which served primarily as a messenger craft, and there would also, in the end, be a fairly large flotilla of small craft, which numbered in total about twice the size of the fleet. This was a mixture of the ship's own boats, for which additional weaponry was to be carried, and then they could be used as coastal attack craft, but there were also various other yachts, barges, and gunboats, some of which sailed with the fleet from England and others would be picked up later on in the voyage. And by these means, a number of men who were unable to join the main fleet contrived to come along anyway. Much gleeful cackling was heard from certain quarters as the more pyromaniacal sailors were encouraged quite openly by Pellew to bring along any and all inventive incendiaries and explosives that they could find, including a worryingly large number of Congreve rockets, for whom a target approximately the size of a city was about right. Marines and engineers were also brought along, for there was a need, at least in the initial plans, for assault troops and sappers. Pellew also found a contingent of smugglers who'd been captured and sentenced to serve in the Navy, and he decided to bring them along as well, reasoning that their familiarity with handling ships and boats close in to shore would be quite useful. As the fleet headed south, Pellew insisted on a strict regimen of gunnery practice, which included, by some accounts, a strange device which could best be thought of as perhaps some very basic form of artillery calculation device, as it was described as a mechanism by which guns could be aimed and fired very accurately. And by the 9th, having swept past a rather astonished Tripolitan corsair who was poking around the Straits of Gibraltar and thought his luck had well and truly ran out, the fleet anchored at Gibraltar to replenish its supplies. Here they found a small squadron of Dutch frigates and a corvette. These were the Melampus, Amstel, Diana, Frederica, Dageraad, and Eendracht, apologies to Dutch listeners, respectively, under the overall command of, apologies again, Admiral Jonkheer Theodorus Frederik von Capellen. This squadron had actually just been in Algiers in an effort to emulate Pellew's success earlier in the year, except of course they were looking to secure the release of Dutch prisoners, but they hadn't had any luck, as a handful of frigates didn't impress the Dey of Algiers all that much. So when they inquired as to just why a large British fleet armed to the teeth was sailing into the Mediterranean when there ostensibly wasn't a war on, and they were told that Pellew intended to blow up most of Algiers and potentially salt the earth as well if he could find a merchant ship that was carrying the appropriate cargo, the Dutch rather immediately asked could they join up. Pellew welcomed them into his command and assigned them the job of attacking the fort that guarded the southern end of the city, which would allow him to consolidate his own forces that he'd otherwise earmarked for that role elsewhere. Having been fully stocked up, and with all ships issued an updated copy of the plans of the city, as well as Pellew's orders, the fleet sailed again, and by mid-August they were almost at their destination, when they were met by the sloop HMS Prometheus, which had tried to rescue the British consul and his family, They had actually managed to get the consul's wife and daughter away, disguised as midshipmen, but the baby of the family and the party who was escorting it had been discovered when the infant, who had been rather cunningly concealed in a large basket of vegetables, had woken up and started crying. As a result, three midshipmen, the ship's surgeon, and 14 men from the Prometheus, along with the consul, were all locked up. The Dey of Algiers at this point being well aware that the British were coming and having activated all possible defences. He did, however, send the baby out to the incoming fleet, which Pellew recorded as what he regarded as the Dey's solitary instance of humanity. The frigate Severn was sent ahead of the fleet to offer Algiers one last chance to comply, while behind it, Pellew's fleet began to spread out across the entrance of the bay. At 1400, the Severn hoisted a signal indicating that Algiers had not just refused terms, they'd refused to answer at all. Pellew immediately hoisted the "Are you ready?" interrogative signal. Every ship ran up affirmatives, and so they all began to close with their appointed positions. Against Pellew's ships, the Corsairs had about 300 heavy guns in various batteries and forts, including some rather monstrous Ottoman bombards throwing shot many times heavier than any ship-mounted gun. Additionally, there were about a dozen warships, a mixture of frigates and corvettes, three dozen gunboats all packed with troops, and about the sum total of all that again in various smaller craft. Initially, the approach was done in silence by both sides, as Pellew had ordered his ships to only have one gun deck, if they had multiple, manned on the way in. This would allow much of the ship's crews to be at the sails. This would allow better control of the ships in confined waters. Once they took their positions and laid out anchors and lines to rotate and warp their ships, the men would go to the guns in full. The Algerians, by contrast, were hoping to lure the Queen Charlotte in close and then board her by massed gunboat assault. They'd also been rather surprised by the speed of Pellew's approach as he'd continued to sail towards the harbour even while negotiations were ostensibly ongoing, and many of the guns were observed to be frantically being loaded and supplies run out to them, even as the Queen Charlotte bore up alongside the mole that was the centrepiece of Algiers' defences. Pellew, of course, had placed himself and his flagship right at the heart of the action. A great many troops, anticipating a landing attempt, had been massed on the mole, and Pellew, drawn up a scant few dozen yards away, actually waved at them to try and get them to go back as they swarmed up on the parapets to have a look at the massive three-decker, which towered over both them and the gun batteries. Although the flagship was in place, other ships were still trying to gain their positions, and so Pellew kept his guns quiet for now. Although once the gun crews were in position, he ordered three cheers to be sounded. However, even as the last cheer died away, the easternmost battery opened a scattered fire on the Superb. They barely got three shots off before Pellew ordered his flagship to open fire in return. The three-decker unleashed a double and triple-shotted broadside at point-blank range into the mole's fortifications in a single colossal volley. Survivors later reported at least 500 troops and gunners were killed by this one salvo alone, and the men reloaded with alacrity, the flagship getting off no less than three full broadsides in the first 3 minutes of the engagement, devastating the mole. The various enemy batteries now began to open up at the British and the Dutch, and the fleet responded. Most of the ships were still slightly out of position, and some were thus caught in a crossfire, and this resulted in the displacement of a few of the smaller ships. The frigates Hebrus and Granicus thus elected to just keep going until they found empty positions near Queen Charlotte at the heart of the action. Soon, as well as the direct cannon fire, the arcs of rockets and shells began to climb over the city from various launches and bomb vessels, and soon both the fortifications and the city as a whole were subjected to a plunging deluge of fire and explosions, along with the more direct hot iron. A front row seat to all of this was unwittingly given to a Danish merchant ship and her crew. The captain had spent most of the previous day remonstrating with the Dey to surrender, as the Danish officer had been unfortunate enough to be present for both previous British attacks on Copenhagen, and so he knew exactly what was coming. Now, he could just sit back and watch it all happen again from the safety of his vessel, presumably either muttering, "I told you so," or "Here we go again," except, of course, in Danish. Having been caught out a little, the Algerian gunboats now advanced, using the pall of gun smoke for cover. This concealed a good chunk of their approach from the Queen Charlotte, but unfortunately for them, it also concealed from them their view of the nearby presence of the Leander. And when they emerged, they found the big frigate was in a perfect flanking position, resulting rather quickly in 33 of the 37 gunboats being sunk in a series of scything broadsides, the remaining four hightailing it back into the smoke. And so the battle progressed. Queen Charlotte quickly ran out of targets at the end of the mole, which had been reduced to a mess of dust, broken masonry and scattered bodies, and then swung about on her lines to target other positions. While elsewhere, the battle was a little bit more even. After about an hour, at around 1600, Leander was ordered to send a boat over to the nearest Corsair frigate and set her ablaze. This was done almost too well, with the boarding party being chased back over the side by rapidly spreading flames. It was hoped that this burning ship would spread its fire and destroy the other major enemy warships, but the frigate burnt through her mooring cables too quickly and drifted out to sea, prompting the various British launches and gunboats in the area to open fire on the next frigate in line using incendiary carcass shells. By about 6 in the evening, this frigate was burning nicely despite the best efforts of its crew to put the fires out, and this time the fire did spread to consume most of the rest of the Corsair fleet, barring a single brig and a schooner who were much further inside the harbour. And in fact, the flames grew so intense that they quickly jumped across to the storehouses alongside the city's piers, and then from there spread to the city's main arsenal with predictably spectacular results. Around sunset, the Impregnable reported that she'd been under a crossfire for several hours and she needed some assistance. But with the wind having mostly died, attempts to reach her by the Glasgow failed, and so Pellew sent a boat, giving Impregnable permission to draw away to make repairs. However, Admiral Milne and Captain Brace refused to withdraw when no other ship was doing so, and so instead Pellew came up with another plan. He remembered that they'd brought an old sloop along from Gibraltar, packed with 143 barrels of gunpowder. It had originally been intended to use it to destroy the Corsair fleet, but since those ships were already pleasingly aflame, the sloop was instead sent over to the Impregnable, which directed her to a particularly annoying gun battery just north of the city's lighthouse. The sloop's crew duly sailed over there, lit the fuses, and retired, with the result being that around 9 in the evening, a huge explosion sent the sloop and the gun battery sky high, although, as it turned out, it was a different battery to the one that Impregnable had actually pointed out. As darkness fell, fire on both sides began to slacken, partially because it was getting harder and harder to see anything, being the combination of darkness and gun smoke, and partly because the fleet had actually used up a lot of its ammunition. Total expenditure across the fleet amounting to 118 tons of powder, 50,000 solid shot, which massed together over 500 tons, almost 1,000 shells from the various bomb vessels, and who knew how many shells of rockets from the various smaller boats. A huge thunderstorm, complete with lightning, broke shortly after darkness fell fully, with the lightning lighting up the bay in strobes of actinic light. The American consul ashore, who was describing the entire proceeding, noted how the flashes illuminated the ships who were still in the bay, even while the burning Corsair fleet and port facilities provided an appropriately dramatic backdrop. Judging that his mission was accomplished for the moment, and, of course, the lightning storm providing a suitably dramatic exit, Pellew ordered the fleet to withdraw for deeper waters for the rest of the night. The casualty count was then compiled. Across the fleet, there were 128 killed and 690 wounded in the British ships, with a further 13 killed and 52 wounded on the Dutch ships. The Impregnable had suffered by far the worst, with 50 dead and 160 wounded, a large number due to an explosion of some sort that had occurred during the action. The next highest casualty figures were on Leander, which had 17 dead and 118 wounded, and then the Queen Charlotte with just 8 dead but 131 wounded. Leander, being a frigate, had thus suffered proportionally more than either of the big ships of the line, At one point in the battle, her rigging had been so cut up by an enemy battery that she'd sent a boat and a line over to the Severn, and by hauling on this line, she'd brought herself around to open fire on said annoying battery and silence it. Exact casualty figures amongst the Algerian defenders were unknown, but were estimated to be between 5 and 6,000. Pellew had seemed to have lived a rather charmed life. A cannon round had taken off the tails of his coat as he paced the deck, a musket round was found to have been stopped by the destruction of his spectacles, which were in his pocket, his telescope had been shot out of his hand, which necessitated quite a lot of British sailor cursing, and various fragments and errant musket fire had cut him across the cheek and the leg. But, outside of superficial cuts, he wasn't actually injured. Pellew then sat down in his cabin and drafted a letter. "To His Highness the Dey of Algiers, Sir, for your atrocities at Bona on defenceless Christians, and your unbecoming disregard to the demands I made yesterday, in the name of the Prince Regent of England, the fleet under my orders has given you a signal chastisement by the total destruction of your navy, storehouses, and arsenal with half your batteries. As England does not want the destruction of cities, I am unwilling to visit your personal cruelties upon the inoffensive inhabitants of the country, and I therefore offer you the same terms of peace which I conveyed to you yesterday in my sovereign's name. Without the acceptance of these terms, you can have no peace with England. If you receive this offer as you ought, you will fire 3 guns, and I shall consider your not making this signal as a refusal, and I shall renew my operations at my own convenience. I offer you the above terms, provided neither the British consul, nor the officers and men so wickedly seized by you from the boats of a British ship of war, have met with any cruel treatment, or any of the Christian slaves in your power, and I repeat my demand that the consul and officers and men may be sent off to me conformable to ancient treaties. Signed, Exmouth, Queen Charlotte, Algiers Bay, 25th of August, 1816. Now, it's said in some secondary sources that this threat was a bluff, as the ships had expended all of their ammunition, but this is incorrect. A closer account of Pellew's papers shows that, in fact, while all ships had expended much ammunition, all vessels still had a reasonable amount left in reserve to renew the action if they needed to. The gunnery practice enforced on the way down, having ensured that British gunfire had been both deliberate and accurate. Indeed, upon examination of Algiers in the aftermath, only a handful of enemy guns could actually be found still mounted and in their original positions. What these papers do reveal, which is perhaps where the confusion came from, is that some ships had expended pretty much all of their powder, but also shows that these vessels were being replenished in the early morning hours by transfers of powder from some of the brigs which had stood out further to sea. Faced with no real way to continue resistance, the Dey responded that he would accept the terms and signed the following document. "The Declaration of His Most Serene Highness Omar Pasha, Dey and Governor of the Warlike City and Kingdom of Algiers, made and concluded with the Right Admiral Edward Baron Exmouth, Knight Grand Cross of the Most Honourable Military Order of the Bath, Admiral of the Blue Squadron of His Britannic Majesty's Fleet, and Commander-in-Chief of His said Majesty's Ships and Vessels in the Mediterranean," take a breath, "in consideration of the deep interest manifested by His Royal Highness, the Prince Regent of England, for the termination of Christian slavery, His Highness the Dey of Algiers, in token of his sincere desire to maintain inviolable his friendly relations with Great Britain, and to manifest his amicable disposition and high respect towards the powers of Europe, declares that, in the event of future war with any European power, not any of the prisoners shall be consigned to slavery, but treated with all humanity as prisoners of war until regularly exchanged according to European practice in like cases, and that at the termination of hostilities they shall be restored to their respective countries without ransom, and the practice of condemning Christian prisoners of war to slavery is hereby formally and forever renounced. Done in duplicate in the warlike city of Algiers, in the presence of Almighty God, the 28th day of August, in the year of Jesus Christ, 1816, and on the 6th day of the moon of the month Shawwal, in the year 1231 of the Hijra." This yielded the surrender of the remaining slaves held in Algiers, bringing the total freed by both expeditions that Pellew had command of that year to just over 3,000 in total. Although these efforts did bring a respite to those travelling in the Mediterranean and living on its shores, in large part because the Algerians no longer had any ships, The rulers of Algiers focused on rebuilding their city and looking to sources of slaves other than the European nations. By 1824, Algiers actually felt strong enough to try its luck again, although they did quickly capitulate when another Royal Navy fleet showed up and threatened to bombard them again. However, while the 1-2 punch of the US expeditions and Pellew's assaults broke much of the Corsairs' power, and with general peace in Europe, naval patrols were far more common off the Barbary coasts, which made the resumption of raiding considerably more difficult, in the end, the only permanent solution turned out to be invasion and occupation, with the French taking Algiers in 1830 and making it a colony. Tripoli and Tunis were considerably quieter, but both would eventually be occupied further down the line during general colonial scrambles.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.